Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talked to Ken Irvine, the Education Coordinator of Guelph Museums. And if you've been to McRae House, then you might have heard Ken Irvine talk about the First World War and the experiences of Colonel John McRae, the Guelph-born doctor who wrote In Flanders Fields. World War I is a topic of conversation in pop culture these days thanks to the Sam Mendes film 1917. Nominated for 10 Academy Awards, 1917 is a strong contender to win Best Picture, but how does the movie and its exceptional attention to detail stand up to the scrutiny of experts who know all the ins and outs of the Great War? The Hollywood War versus the real war is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, the plot of 1917 is simple. Two soldiers are assigned to race against the time and deliver a message that will stop 1,600 men from walking straight into a deadly trap. The film was co-written and directed by Mendes, who is the Academy Award-winning director of American Beauty, and it has an interesting creative concept. 1917 was shot and staged as if it were a two-hour movie unfolding as one continuous shot. It's a logistical feat that's been attempted before by a couple of bold directors, including Alfred Hitchcock and Alejandro G. Iñárritu, but never has anyone tried to use this storytelling device for a war movie before. Now, we reviewed 1917 a few weeks back on End Credits, and while watching it, I thought to myself, what would the staff of McRae House think of this movie? McRae House is an inexhaustible source of information and insight into life during World War I, and I spent some time there as a volunteer about 10 years ago. While helping out with the school programs, I heard the stories with the kids about what life was like for the soldiers on the front line, the horrors they saw, the struggles they faced, and some of the things that don't make it into a history textbook that only covers the big battles and the political maneuvering. 1917 echoed a lot of what I remember during my time as a volunteer, and I wanted to put that notion to the test, and Ken Irvine was kind enough to accept the challenge. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, Irvine and I will retrace the plot of the movie and talk about whether Mendes' attention to detail pays off for someone who brings the real history to life on a daily basis. We talk about the plausibility of the movie's central mission, his thoughts and feelings on the war in the real 1917, and how well the two main characters represent real soldiers in the British regiments on the Western Front. We also discuss the artistic aspects of the film and how well the art directors recreated the trenches, how well the costume designers captured war uniforms and their field kits, and how well the special effects artists captured the death and human misery on the line. And finally, we will talk about where historical accuracy goes wrong and what Irvine would like to see in war movies that he's never seen before. So I caught up with Ken Irvine last week in studio, and needless to say, if you have not seen 1917 yet and would like to, spoilers follow. Ken Irvine, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So the movie starts with our two protagonists woken. They're stirred from what looks like a peaceful sleep. This was not uncommon. Like this in World War I, it wasn't nonstop action. There were long stretches of tedium, broken occasionally by having to go up over the hill.
Exactly. Exactly. they always say it's 2 hours of horror with, 2 days of nothing to do. having a few minutes to lay in the sun would just be heaven for them. And the soldiers look for a chance to get a break, get out of the trenches, and just relax and let their hearts settle. Like they had the stress of always being fired on. If they're out of the lines, they had a chance to breathe and a little peace. Mm-hmm. And that would have been just beautiful for them.
It reminded me a bit of like a lot of the stories I would hear at McRae House. Particularly the long stretches you were in the trench, like, and you see this when the two soldiers, Blake and Schofield, start walking through the trenches, that there are actually alcoves built into the side of the trench where that was where you slept for a couple of days. Yeah.
They had these little areas cut into the sides called funk holes that, would be your shelter. You could be out of the rain and the wind a little bit. They also had dugouts, mm-hmm. Where usually the officers stayed, but also places where the soldiers could get out of the wind and the weather. And they were usually about 3 meters underground. Mm. And that was meant they were relatively bombproof. Mm. And they showed that really well in the movie. I thought it was the representation of the trenches was very well done.
Well, let's walk back a bit. I mean, overall, how did the movie strike you in terms of not just maybe, I don't expect you to give the review like your A.O. Scott or something, but, you know, as someone who's spent, you know, not an inconsiderable amount of your life ensconced in this time period, how did it strike you? What did what you saw on screen accurately reflect what that might have looked like?
I thought they did a very good job in the realism. The uniforms, the equipment, the trenches were all really well done. Things like I was watching the movie, I was like, okay, are they going to do this? And then they did it. And it's like, oh, that's good. Well done. And then...
Well,
when they went into the German dugouts and they're just going, well, this is too safe and secure. There's got to be booby traps because this is something the Germans did. And then, oh, lo and behold, there's a booby trap.
Right.
So things that, you know, I'm thinking, this happened. Are they going to do this? And then they picked up on it. And so they did things like that really well. And they brought out, there's so many intricacies of the First World War you could talk about or relay in the movie. But... they picked up some of the highlights really well and to showcase it, because really First World War movies are not an American thing or not a big popular blockbuster thing in Hollywood. Right. If the Americans aren't in it, it doesn't seem like they show it.
Right.
So this was an entirely British movie, and to have it so well received in the United States and have it as an Oscar contender, it's a really pleasant happening.
I wonder, and this maybe gets off the beaten track a little, but I've wondered this out loud and talking to people about 1917, that if it feels World War One in general feels a bit more relevant today than it maybe did in the past, because we're still living through wars that seem to go on forever, that seem to have no end in sight, that have no like spoken objective. Like in World War II, the goal was to get to Berlin.
Yeah.
There was nothing like that in World War One,
and the soldiers thought, you know, what is the purpose? What are they doing? And you know, they didn't initially hate the Germans, and that's why they were the Christmas truces, because they once they met the Germans, they said, you know, these guys are just like us; they're just normal people, and the whole purpose of the war was lost to a lot of people. Mm. So when they met up with the opposing soldiers, they just like, why are we even fighting? So. That's why the generals really put a big end to that. But there wasn't the same purpose that you saw in the Second World War of getting rid of the tyrant and the tyranny. It was more of an imperialistic kind of nationalistic war.
And you get a bit of that in this movie, too, that even though it's 1917, when there's a scene where a German plane crashes and it's on fire, and the immediate human reaction of the two soldiers is to get the pilot out and save the pilot.
Pull him out. He's just another guy.
Yeah.
But then the repercussions of that was I was shocked by that. I didn't expect that part. And that was a good bit of film.
Yeah. Yeah. It lampshades the expectations too. The two soldiers themselves, Blake and Schofield, I feel like they represent two very different points of view about the war at various points. But I mean, to set it in 1917, in April 1917, is an interesting point in time, because you would have the Schofields who had seen some things. And I think it's actually out and out mentioned he was at the Somme.
Yeah,
at the
Battle of the Somme. He had won a military medal, I think he mentioned.
Yeah. So he's very much has a been there, seen that approach to the war. And then you have Blake, who seems to be very... fresh, very, maybe he's arrived a couple of months ago, but in terms of the general overall feeling of the men, you know, where were they sitting at psychologically at this point?
I think Schofield was, it was a good representation, because he did, you know, he didn't see the point of it. He didn't see the glory in it. He traded his medal for wine. So it's, and I'm sure that wasn't a bad thing, the good French wine. But it's something that, you know, he lost the glory. It was a job. And it's something he wanted to get through and get home. So he didn't see the glory or the heroism. He just wanted to do his job and get through it. Mm-hmm. So that was a really good representation. And seeing, you know, the younger buck coming out and wanting to, you know, prove his prowess and some bravery, and all he had a job to do, and it was a family thing. Like it's it was a big part of his heart to rescue his brother and bring him back. But you could see a little bit more of that in him, that he, you know, he wanted to, you know, show off and maybe win a medal. And
And actually, I think one of them, I think Schofield says at some point, like, yeah, this will get you your medal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Kind of offhandedly, too. Like, what, you know, what's the big deal?
You'll win your cross, you know.
How about the mission? Because the mission is that these two men have to carry a note, basically a note from their general that says, hey, stop this attack tomorrow. Yeah. It's a trap. The whole idea of like sending two men on their own, I think it's 9 miles down the road through no man's land, down the road through enemy territory. Because I think the general says the wires were cut and so they can't send a message that way. Would this be maybe not a common mission, but does like the mission itself, does it make sense beyond just sort of like the MacGuffin of it? The we need a setup to send these two guys on their way.
Well, they did have runners, and that was part of the job. There were people who were just runners for messengers. There were also, they could have used passenger pigeons or those were something to tie a note to the leg, but they weren't 100% reliable. You know, they also had light signals. They would flash. They had flags, but a runner was the most reliable. As long as he got there, he could deliver the most accurate note. And they used, you know, hundreds and hundreds of runners. It was a dangerous job.
Yeah.
It was really dangerous, and you know, a lot of time runners didn't make it through.
You know what the mortality rate was?
I don't. I know they did pick a lot of the younger, fitter guys who could do the job. And it was interesting. There were a lot of First Nations that were runners.
Really?
Tong Longboat was a runner who was a Canadian Olympian. And he was a runner in the First World War for the Canadian Forces. So... They used people who were strong and fit and able to withstand some of the rigors and do it fast.
Because, you know, they weren't just hauling the letter, which is a piece of paper. It's nothing. Yeah. But, you know, they had to haul all the equipment, too. What was the poundage of a kit?
A normal battlefield kit was about 60 pounds.
Yeah.
So you got 60 pounds worth of gear. And when you're going into battle, you carried a little bit more. Like they would have stripped down a little bit. They wouldn't have had the same hand grenades, but and as many rations as they would have carried normally into battle, because you wanted to carry about 3 days worth of food and a day's worth of water and, you know, so many, usually about 150 rounds of ammunition. So they may have stripped down a bit, but still you got a pretty good weight on your back. And when you're slugging through the mud and muck that's literally sucking the boots off your feet with every step, it's not an easy task.
Right. And I feel that that's kind of, it's not directly addressed, but I don't know if it was intentional on the part of San Mendes, but I have a feeling it probably was, that there are a lot of scenes where you see their boots in close-up just caked in mud.
Yeah.
And just the reality of these boots were probably stuck to your feet for a good long time.
Yeah, some guys didn't get their boots off for days and days, and that's how trench foot occurred.
Yeah.
And there were stories of people, that, like even John McCrae. He wrote about during the Second Battle of Ypres that for 17 days he didn't get his boots off once. So that's how you get trench foot. Your feet are wet and damp and cold, then the circulation stops and your skin starts to rot. Having mud caked on you was a very normal occurrence. And I know some soldiers who had, in the winter, they had trench coats, and they would be over 60 pounds when they had the mud and water caked into them. And they would actually cut the bottom edges of their trench coats off just to cut off that weight.
Right.
Because they're standing, you know, up to their knees in mud and muck for hours. So you don't want to have to drag that down with you with the extra weight of the coat.
Speaking of trench foot, this might be, in the film, the first case of trench hand, because there is a scene when they are going over through no man's land. I think it's Schofield that cuts his hand on some barbed wire, and then they're making their way through no man's land, going into all the crevasses and the craters, and he accidentally sticks that hand into a body when they are surprised by rats.
And that's not just Hollywood. That happened.
Yeah.
There's a lot of instances of that occurring, and it was... Yeah, infections, you never washed. You didn't have a good chance for a wash or a scrub. And and you'd be caked in dirt. You'd be eating with mud on your hands. You'd be scraping the mud off the crust of bread that you're eating. You know, these guys were immersed in the bacteria and the filth of the war. And, you know, having a cut, a wide open cut, and then sticking it in a body, not the first time it happened yet, but I've read a lot of diary occurrences where, you know, people fell into a corpse and their hands went up to their elbows. And it's the realism was there.
I remember one story you said, told some kids, and they were older kids, so it was okay, but about a pair of soldiers who went for cover into a crater, and they thought they were up to their waist in mud, but they were up to their waist in human remains, because human remains had liquefied, had been left in the crater so long.
Yeah, that was the Canadians were actually, they had captured a German trench, and one of these trenches was just filled with German corpses, and it was sort of a mass burial. And they were tasked to dig another trench. And as they were doing that, there was a bombardment that hit with shrapnel flying all around, and the only place for cover was this mass grave. And so they dove into that, were up to their knees in liquefied remains, and were there for 2 or 3 hours. And then when they got out, they're covered in this awful gore.
Yeah.
And then they had to go back to their job. Like, they didn't have a chance to wash or clean up. And the guys were in this trench retching and puking, and the flies are around them. And it would have been just horrific. Like, it's unimaginable kind of gore. And, then their officer says, well, back to your duty, back to your job, and go on with it. And you spend the rest of the day smelling of death. It's hard to even imagine what these guys went through and the smells. And that's one thing that the movie can't bring out, is like the smell-o-vision.
Yeah.
Because... You know,
probably thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully. Because the smells would have been just unbelievable. And I like the fact that he did show the flies. Mm. There was a dead horse in no man's land, and the flies are buzzing around it. And that was a small representation. There would have been clouds. Like, the horses would have been black with flies. Huh. So you couldn't even see them. And... I know my father fought in the Second World War, and he talked about when he was at the Falaise Gap that the flies were so thick you thought the ground was moving. It was just this black vibration to the ground because there were so many flies. And he said that you couldn't even take a spoonful of soup from your bowl to your mouth without getting it covered with flies. And so the flies, they showed it a little bit in the movie, but it would have been much more than that.
There's such a wastefulness to it, and that's a quality of war in itself, but to see it visualized, it's people left abandoned in no man's land, proper burial for these guys, and horses left abandoned and half decayed, and you could see like the exposed skeleton, I guess, because they've been feeding on by vermin, flies and rats and things. It's just the incredible waste of it is galling.
and that was well displayed. I thought the realism for that aspect was really well done in the movie.
So to get back to the plot, they make their way across no man's land. They get into the German trenches, and they are surprised that the German trenches are nicer than the British trenches. And that is also a real thing. The Germans were very good making trenches.
Very efficient at their trench building. They were there first. They set in their trenches first. They set the places where they were going to defend. They picked the high ground. They picked really well-defended areas. And then they dug deep, and they dug well. And Germans were known for their efficiency. And they dug, they had sandbagged walls. They had concrete walls. They had wooden walls. They built really to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see them leaving such a well-fortified position... makes you think they're moving to something better.
Right.
You realize that they're not leaving that for something worse. They're moving back, they're solidifying their lines, and they're going to a better place.
Mm-hmm.
It's eye-opening. And I know the Canadians, they were very good at digging the trenches. The British were good. They hated taking over trenches from the French. The French were horrible at it. Because the French attitude was, we're not here for a long time. We're just going to dig it for protection. And they had this elan that they wanted to always on the move, always to go forward. And they didn't want to stay put for very long, but that didn't work out that way. But So what, the Canadians hated taking over the French because the French also didn't dig latrines really. So they would it would be filled with filth. So you go in and it's just, oh gosh, not the French again.
But, you would always know where the French were.
But yeah, and they knew that the Germans dug deep and dug well, and they were they were well fortified.
I wonder if that's a quality of, because the fighting was in France, and you know, maybe there was a French thinking that, you know, we don't want to blight our countryside with these, something that might end up being even semi-permanent, you know.
Possibly, but, yeah.
It's interesting. The thing that I found, you know, it makes you wonder, right? Because the Germans were really great at building trenches, and there was a shrewdness, and they had some remarkable advancements too. It makes you wonder about where it all kind of went wrong for them. That, I mean, again, this is 1917 we're talking about. It's a year and a bit till the end of the war, and Germany was pretty stretched thin at this point.
Yeah, their manpower was running low. Their supplies, their food was really depleted. The blockade that the Allies had done to the German ports was working. The German people were starving. The soldiers weren't getting the same amount of calories that the British were getting. When they ever captured a British trench, they were always amazed by the amount of food that they would find there compared to what they were getting. And, you know, they had sausages that were half filled with sawdust. And, you know, they were still getting their beer and their schnapps. but they weren't getting the calories that was the French and the British were getting. And that was because of the blockade that was really working.
Well, moving on again to the plot, we have our two men. They make it to beyond the village, or beyond the trenches. They're traveling through the forest, and they come to a farm. And this is where we get the plane crash scene and the pilot who kills Blake, forcing Schofield to go on. And again, going back to the waste of human life, but they leave Blake there.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's understandable. You have Schofield meets up with other men who are moving elsewhere. But I did wonder at the end, did anyone go back and get Blake?
There were burial parties that would have come through and picked him up and buried him properly. When Schofield was leaving him, he took off his rings and there were his identification collars.
Right.
They weren't called dog tags. That's an American thing.
Right.
But he left. There were two of them. One's left with the body. One's taken.
And that's the point. Because you always see the dog tags. What we call dog tags. There's two of them, and it's one's left with the body, and one's left is taken. So that's proof of death, I guess.
Yeah. So that was realistic. He still had a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
So he went on and did it, and it must have been the hardest thing in the world. It's to leave your friend, and that's something everyone who lost a friend had to do. You know, they had the best friends of their lives were usually guys that they worked with in the war, that they were comrades in arms, and you know, you're never closer to them than you are with the people that you fight with beside. So it would have been a tough thing for him to do, but he knew his duty and moved on.
I mean, I imagine that also contributed a lot to what they would call at the time shell shock, what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. That, you know, and this gets into the sort of the arts and crafts of the scene, but there is the scene where Schofield, after he leaves Blake behind, gets in the back of that truck and the camera just focuses on him, and he's not saying anything, he's not engaging the others in conversation. He definitely wears that shock on his face.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's well shown.
Yeah. Do we know how many, like, people came back? I mean, even just Canadians came back, like, not necessarily with like physical injuries, but with the mental ones. Was that ever even flirted with as something to keep track of?
There's never a statistic because not all of it was documented.
Right.
And there were suicides after the war that were never really attributed to the war. It's a statistic that will never be known. Just because people self-medicated with alcohol.
Right.
After the war, the Legion was the best thing in the world for these guys because they could go in, they could commiserate with their comrades, they could have a couple beers, and they could relate to what they went through with other people who also went through it. I've talked to so many veterans at McRae House who come in and they'll tell me some of their stories, and their wife will be standing beside them and saying, oh my God, I lived with him for 60 years and he's never said this once. Mm. So they want to talk to someone who that can understand what they've gone through. And that's why the Legions were so good. So these guys may have had PTSD. They've gone to Legion. They got out, released their burden with their friends.
Right.
The number of people who were treated during the war, it wasn't always officially documented as shell shock. They would have put it down as other instances, or but it would be hard to determine.
And it's always, you know, it's World War II, granted, but, you know, the best years of our lives, that Wyler movie, where all the wives, you know, are saying, like, can't you just get over it? Can't you just leave the war behind?
No, you can't.
Yeah. Well, back to Schofield's solo journey. He gets to a decimated village. He falls under fire from a sniper, and he is he's able to take out the sniper, but not before he has a fall and hits his head and wakes up in the dead of night. It's at this point, you know, I was wondering, you know, there is light from some flares going off somewhere. A building's been set on fire in the distance, but and I think there was some discussion early on in the, like, shouldn't we, like, move at night, you know, but the matter of distance that they had to move in daylight. How easy or how often were like, you know, for these runners, like, to move in the dead of night? We're not talking about how, you know, getting around in an area where there's streetlights. You're in the middle of the countryside, and even
it
like...
It was pitch dark.
It was pitch dark,
You relied on moonlight a lot.
Yeah.
And there are some times that they had to wait for certain battles to... what is the moon going to be like that night? And hopefully it's a clear night. And sometimes you didn't do anything at night because you knew the moon was going to be out. And the Germans might set up flares. And you wanted the pitch dark.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of felt your way through no man's land, or felt your way through things and hope for some. And your eyes would adjust eventually. Mm. But it would have been really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But the flares actually were amazing. They did really work well, and they lit up large portions of the battlefield. And that's something that the soldiers, when they got caught out in no man's land with a flare going off, they were told just freeze, don't move, because movement would attract attention. Just freeze, even if you're standing up.
It would automatically register.
Yeah.
In that, again, it's also a great bit of the art of cinema. Those scenes. He's going through the decimated town, and he encounters a civilian, a woman, and a baby. The baby isn't the woman's, but she's kind of found the baby. What was it like? You know, we see these towns and we see the pictures, like just like towns laid to waste. But is this a thing that happened, that like people tried to live in the hovel, that they still tried to make, you know, make it, you know, living in a broken building?
People did still try to live amongst the ruins of their old homes.
Yeah.
They still try to make a living. So if the Germans were in that area, they might have been trying to sell them chocolate or beer or something to make a few dollars. An estimate, the French always ran little bars and pubs and cafes that catered to the soldiers there, and they could charge astronomical amounts. Like, they were, I know the Canadians, you know, a couple of eggs and a bottle of wine, you know, eggs were like a dollar each in some places. They're like a day's wage for these guys, but they didn't get them anywhere else.
Right.
They'd get some, you know, French fries or hash browns and some eggs and a bottle of wine, and that was heaven. It was way better than what they were getting of the canned food they had regularly. So these French people tried to cater to the needs of some of the soldiers. And so that wasn't uncommon.
And the French fries are a Belgian thing, I want to say. So that, like, so it's very much a European kind of speciality. So it would also doubles as kind of like a treat.
Yes.
You're on the continent, so you get French fries.
But yeah, and, you know, there were also, you know, brothels up close to the front to look after all the soldiers' needs. And so they kept things, you know, going. And if the soldiers needed, you know, razor blades or whatever, just personal items, they might be able to get them at the front by people who are in charge of an arm and a leg for them.
But
but they're also risking their lives to be up that close.
Right.
And these are their homes. Some people just didn't want to leave their ancestral homes, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to hustle, I guess.
Yeah. It's, true.
So, Schofield, he has to evade some Germans. It seems like at this point he's lost his entire kit, and it's just a matter of running for his life. It did make me wonder, like, because I know soldiers often have to pay for the uniforms and things. Would he have to pay for his kit and his gun, or would he? They just like rearm him and send him back.
That was one of the parts of the movie that I found a little hard, because he dropped his gun and it's like, no, you wouldn't.
Don't drop your gun.
You would never have left your gun behind, because that was your saving grace. That was your life. That was something, your best friend. That's what they call your rifle is your best friend.
Right.
And to just leave it behind without picking up another weapon. That was one of the parts of the movie that I just said, oh, I don't know about that.
Would he have a sidearm? Would it typical?
No,
they just had the rifle?
He would have had a rifle. He would have had a bayonet. Possibly would have had some grenades. But okay. With the mission that he was on, I doubt he would have carried grenades.
Mm.
But yeah, he would have been, you know, had a 303 Lee Enfield rifle with a bayonet. And that's about all he left with, it seems.
Mm.
Officers carried sidearms.
Mm-hmm.
He might have had a dagger or something with him. But, yeah, he looks like he was fitted out very normally with this kit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was surprised when he didn't have his weapon with him. And he could have been charged with, like, a really stickler officer.
Right.
Might have come up to him about it. But they, like I said, when they cut off part of their greatcoats or their trench coats, they got charged for that.
Right.
If they got caught doing that.
Yeah.
Because it's considered army property, not yours.
Right, right. It also reminded me, too, that there were some pains taken to not make the soldiers, like, in sort of our modern depiction, where our soldier is, like, expertly trained for months, if not years. The way the actor playing Schofield would hold the gun very much says that holding a gun is not... or has not been an everyday occurrence for this man. It's a relatively new addition to his life.
Yeah, he did not grow up carrying a rifle,
right?
Which some people do, but no, it's something new to him.
Yeah. So we won't go into like the whole how he ends up finding the unit he needs to find, but he gets there, and it is the morning of the battle. And this group of soldiers, they've been split into can you talk a little bit like how this army is? It's a division of 1,600 men, but they are going over the trench in waves.
In waves, so there'd be certain battalions that would leave and go in waves, and they'd try to see how well their first wave did before they'd send the second wave, and they might reinforce the first wave with a second wave or a third wave, and then. If the first wave was unsuccessful, they might just hold them back.
Mm.
So they didn't want to commit everyone. And they never, ever sent everyone in a group or a unit. They always try to keep about 15% back. So they would be at least a training core for new soldiers coming in. There'd always be a few people back. They would know what to do and know how the life in the trenches was and how to deal with the Germans.
Right. The preparation for this one group, I mean, I call it preparation, but it is someone is singing. They are singing to, I guess, maybe what I gather from it is like a way to sort of calm nerves before they're marched into the trench to go over the side.
I think it would have just been relaxing, take your mind off of what you're going to be dealing with in the next little while. And it's a snapshot of home. It's a little bit of home. Close your eyes and you're not in the war.
Mm.
You just hear this lovely voice.
Were there, like, I wonder if there were men who, you know, maybe had singing experience back home, like, or is it just like, hey, does anyone want to, you know, sing or tell a joke or, I don't know.
I haven't heard of a lot of instances of people gathering around to listen to song, but they did have groups of men like that were entertainers.
Yeah.
So they would put on performances behind the lines and they were the soldiers. So they would put on skits and plays and tell jokes and sing songs. And they'd do, you know, there'd be some cross-dressing. The guys would dress up as girls in the girls' parts. And Yeah, there was amazing entertainers that actually carried some of their skills back to Canada and went on the road with it after the war. Some from Guelph, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there was well-known entertainers that and entertained the troops and looked after them, kept them going. They also got a chance to see movies, too.
Yeah,
Charlie Chaplin was huge with the men.
Right. I was thinking, too, about another World War One movie that came out last year, the Peter Jackson documentary.
Oh, yes.
They Shall Never Grow Old, yeah. Which you talking about movies right now, it makes you remember that was new technology. That wasn't, yes. You know, that there were a lot of, and I think it's mentioned in the documentary that, you know, people would see the cameras and be in awe. Like, this was an amazing thing. Like, oh, you're going to take a picture of me and then it's going to show me like hanging out here in the trench. And
yeah, they show people just stop moving and look and turn in the camera. And,
right.
And just, no, keep about your business. But no, they just stop and it's like, what is this? This is so, because I'm sure they've never seen a movie camera before in their lives.
Right. Yeah. So Schofield achieves his mission. We get to the climax. The men are going over the side, but he manages to reach the colonel. And deliver the message despite much effort. The thing that struck me is he delivers the message to the colonel. The colonel reads it, orders the advancement to stop. And then he thanks Schofield and says, you know what? Some other kid might run up here next week and tell us it's a go. And there's a real futility to that, isn't it?
Yes. That's a great way to put it. It's just, it's like, what have I just done? Like, was it worth the exhaustion and the horror and losing my best friend for this?
And then he's the major's there and basically says, good on you, lad.
Yeah.
And I mean, that seems, and then he's going to go and get a hot meal behind the lines. But I mean, that seems to be the extent of the gratitude.
Yeah. It's like, thanks, shake your hands, off you go, get a hot meal and clean up.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Yeah. Although there is the touching scene where he does meet Blake's brother.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones fans will take note that it's, you know, Robb Stark is Tommen Baratheon's brother in 1917. But, you know, and he gives the brother the rings and the dog tag. And this is, I think, an underappreciated aspect of actually – this and the Second World War, too, that, you know, you had brothers who went to war, and they weren't, I mean, for obvious reasons, were rarely in the same division, and it just, you know.
In the First World War, that was different.
Yeah.
There were brothers that signed up together. There were whole communities that signed up in one unit, and when that unit was decimated, communities lost all their young men.
Yeah.
So it happened. There were, like, soccer teams that would join up en masse, and then that soccer team was gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wiped out community. So they stopped doing that. They thought it would be a great recruitment tool at the start of the war to join up with your mates, join up with your pals. And then they realized that let's split these guys up. Let's not keep them all together.
Yeah. It sounds kind of like when you go fundraising, like sign up your team.
And, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, you'll be the Croydon Bulldogs or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, you'll kill all the Germans. And yeah, that. I mean, that's sort of the unappreciated aspect of this, just like the sheer, you know, a whole town's worth of young men.
Yeah, families were just decimated.
Yeah.
There was one group of five brothers in the Second World War who were all on the same battleship that got sunk. They were American, but it's like that whole family just lost all their sons.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just devastating. So,
and it was around that point the army started thinking, you know, that...
this is not a smart
thing. That's not a smart thing. That, you know, and I think that's where the story, the basis for the story that became Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah,
that, you know,
exactly.
At least send one boy home.
Yeah.
As it were. Do you watch a lot of World War One movies generally? I mean, as a sort of like part of like even just as an interest, the topic of
it's
interest?
It's an interest of mine. And,
yeah.
I try to keep on top of it, and it's something that helps with my job too. And I can critique them a little bit. I enjoy them. There's not a lot of good ones.
Oh, really?
Not a lot of recent good ones.
Okay.
That's
fair enough.
This was a good one. The Canadian one Passchendaele that came out a number of years ago has parts of it are very well done and parts of it are more entertainment.
Right.
And talking to a friend of mine, Tim Cook, who's an author of several First World War books, he said, you know, there's too much passion in Passchendaele. and that's hits a nail on the head. Like, it's just a perfect analysis of it.
Right. I mean, it was very much kind of an Americanization of a Canadian story. It's like somebody saw Pearl Harbor and said, we can do the Canadian version of that.
But yeah.
Fair enough. So, you know, taking all this knowledge that you have from like the real history, has there ever been something you wanted to see from a World War One movie that you think is this is an important detail that if you're going to see something in a movie and sort of take your history from those kind of cues, that maybe this is something you should understand or something that you should get as like a detail in a movie is you know, what's missing from these movies, do you think?
One area that they don't really focus on a lot in any movie I've seen is the tunneling. Because there were thousands of men who were digging underground, and tunneling was a huge part of the lives, digging dugouts and digging tunnels under no man's land, digging under the German lines to build mines. It was a huge part of it, and it's just an aspect of the war that people don't think about. There's at Vimy Ridge, the Canadians had 18 kilometers of tunnels. Like, who dug those?
Right.
Obviously the Canadians did. And so there's that story's been really untold, and I think that would be a really fascinating one. It's not as visual underground as up top, but but it's still a component of the lives that thousands of men had to deal with. So that, I think that would be really interesting to deal with. You know, there's lots of movies about the generals and the officers. It's nice to see the regular grunts, the men in the trenches, get shown in this movie. And show the hardships that they dealt with it too.
Well, maybe next Oscars we'll get the Tunnel Rat movie. Well, Ken Irvine, thank you so much for your time and your expertise, and we're glad you like the movie.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. I hope it does well at the Oscars.
And once again, that was Ken Irvine. McRae House is open Wednesdays from 1 to 5 p.m. or by appointment by calling 519-836-1221. If you'd like to learn more about the programs and the collections at McRae House, you can go to Guelph Museum's website at guelphmuseums.ca. 1917 is still currently in theaters everywhere. The Oscars, of course, air this Sunday night, and if you would like to watch it with a crowd, the E-Bar will be holding its annual watch party hosted by Athena McQueen, and you can get all those details at thebookshelf.ca. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus, and to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. Also, when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you'll get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is also the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please do consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, see you next time.